Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, white lightning, homebrew, hooch, whatever you call it, moonshine is the original American rebel spirit, a versatile liquor that spans generations, political lines, and genders. With recent trends having ushered in a new golden age of moonshine, now is the perfect time to uncover the story of the moonshiners who became folk heroes and how their stories and batches of Triple X endured. We're joined by John Schlemm. He's award-winning author of the new book, Moonshine, a celebration of America's original rebel spirit, the ultimate must-have book for aspiring moonshine connoisseurs, history buffs, and party seekers everywhere. John Schlemm, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hey, it is so great to be with all of you and all of your listeners out in Utah.
Well, you know, out in Utah, indeed, it's not Appalachia. But I will say, and you know, we're not going to call out anyone by name, but there are a few moonshiners that we know in this town. So I thought it was interesting because I really knew nothing about moonshine, and yet I know that it's making this resurgence and people are purchasing stills that they keep out in their garage or wherever, and they're doing it. So tell us about this. Well, first of all, this resurgence.
Well, it's so great that after 250 years, the moonshiners have finally been legitimized. They finally have reached their American dream. And certainly you guys as endurance athletes can appreciate this. You know, what they did was possibly, you know, one of the greatest endurance feats of all time. They never gave up. And here we are in 2018, and there are moonshine distilleries popping up across the country. It's now legal. I'm not so sure about the ones in people's garages. They might want to keep their doors down. But certainly the ones in the distilleries are really giving us some of the best of the best. And, you know, the original moonshiners, they were some of the original immigrants to our country before the United States was even the United States. And from there, they've been interwoven in throughout the history of our country in so many really cool ways, which was part of what I wanted to capture in the historical portion of this book. I really want to just capture that rebel spirit, which I think exists in all of us. And again, yeah. You as an endurance athlete, you understand that because you have to call upon that spirit when you're out there doing what you do. And so it was just a great joy to be able to tell their story.
Well, John, you don't even know what we do, but Lynn does, because there's a race that we have every year at the end of the season. It's called the Tour de Suds, and it obviously has some origins in suds, which you're very familiar with also.
Yes.
But at the about three-quarters point in that race, and it's not really an endurance race. It takes about an hour, maybe an hour and a half. You go past an aid station for an adult beverage, and it's our local version of moonshine distilled locally here, and you probably know the people. You know, it's a well-known local whiskey distillery, and they hand out a little shot and then a chaser of beer, and in the middle of your endurance race. Lynn didn't do it this year, but she has done it in the past. And I did both the adult beverage and the chaser.
Wow. I can't imagine a better way to, take a pause during a race. You probably don't even get to pause. You're probably in mid-stride.
I kept going. I just rolled along.
It's a mountain bike race, so it's pretty easy to keep going.
Says Lynn, who didn't do it.
Well, I'm
in complete awe of the fact that you both do that, because I would be there at that midway point cheering you on, but I don't think I could be on the bikes or running with you guys, but I would certainly cheer you on and hand you that shine.
Well, John, I'm really glad that you somehow tied moonshine into athletics, and you know, our show, The Mountain Life, is all about health, nutrition, and fitness. And every so often, we diverge into something like moonshine, just because it's pretty interesting. And yes, it shapes sort of the culture of our country, and there's so much history. One of the things that I like that you do is you highlight these Moonshiners Hall of Fame, and I think it's the very first one that you talk about, who's like a 15-year-old or something like that. Talk about him. He was 14, Robert Glenn Jr. Johnson. And then there's a tie into why and how NASCAR was created.
Yeah, that's one of the little known facts about moonshine, which has been so cool to be able to share, that we really would not have NASCAR in the way we have it if it weren't for moonshine. It was really those early moonshiners and bootleggers who were racing around in their cars in the hollers and back hills down south, taking the moonshine to where it needed to be, who then transitioned into cow pastures, racing around cow pastures on the weekends because they had a little bit of an ego. You know, each of them thought they were the fastest. And eventually, you know, some entrepreneurs came in and formalized these races in cow pastures and turned that into NASCAR. And Junior Johnson, who you mentioned, he was a bootlegger. He got in trouble with the law a little bit. But he was also one of NASCAR's first superstars. And he has his own line of moonshine called Midnight Moon, which is really fantastic. And you can find it in just about any liquor store across the country. So really, in every jar of Junior Johnson's Midnight Moon, you have so much history and heritage there, which is kind of cool. But I did an entire chapter in the book on how moonshine literally paved the way for NASCAR.
And John, to bring it back to local history and lore, what's the difference between that moonshine and High West Distilleries whiskey?
Well, I'm not exactly sure of how they make their whiskey, but a lot has to do with the distilling and the ingredients that are used. Certainly for moonshine, you know, something that I really like about it is, you know, pure moonshine is very clean and about as natural as you can get. It's made from fresh water, corn, yeast, and that's about it. So you can't get much cleaner. You know, and dare I say, maybe healthy, I don't know, a little bit doesn't hurt anybody, but you don't have a lot of the processed garbage that's in a lot of other foods and alcohol. You don't have as much of the sugar, but then, of course, there are all the flavored moonshines out there that are great to try as well. But, you know, whiskey, it's a slightly different distilling process. I'm an equal opportunist. I love both moonshine and whiskey. You know, they're not the same thing, but they're certainly close cousins and bring a lot of joy to a lot of us.
And if I were to walk into a bar, maybe this is a regional thing, or maybe it doesn't even exist, but I'm under the impression that I could look up at, you know, the bottles that are presented and presenting what beverages you can get. And in certain parts of the country, I might see a row or a number of moonshine offerings in addition to whiskeys and scotches and bourbons.
Absolutely. And, you know, that really also speaks to this moment, this golden moment of renaissance, really, that moonshine is having across the country. You can go anywhere from, you know, a favorite dive bar. I love dive bars, to, you know, some of the fanciest bars in the country. And you can find moonshine and moonshine cocktails on those menus. And people are having a lot of fun with moonshine. And that's really why I included the second part of the book, where I created over 100 moonshine infusion and moonshine cocktail recipes. Because, I believe in when you write a book on a certain topic, I believe as a writer, you really should contribute something fresh and new to the conversation. And so I really wanted to offer a full party in a book. So you get a little bit of the history as well as, the fun happy hour aspect.
So as an equal opportunity advocate for both whiskey and moonshine, how would you compare the two for our listeners? Is there a way to distill down the difference in taste and experience?
I think that, you know, a lot of the whiskeys out there tend to be a little smoother to sip. You know, moonshine, it has a little bit more burn to it, and I mean that in the best possible way. So, you know, I think moonshine is definitely like the next step in, especially if you're going to have it just over the rocks. You know, I love it just as a sipper, especially if it's like an apple pie moonshine or a peach moonshine, one of the infusions. But if you're going to have it straight up, you know, it's a little bit stronger than, say, whiskey over ice.
Does corn, is it an essential ingredient, or is it always the grain that gets distilled is in moonshine? Is it always corn?
Not necessarily. There are some other grains that are used. I'm really only familiar, though, with, you know, the corn being used. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the great thing about this era we live in is we have a lot of very adventurous and experimental distillers out there who are doing a lot of really cool things on the moonshine front. So I think certainly in the years ahead, you're going to see moonshine taking on so many different forms and evolutions. And it's just a really exciting time, you know, to sort of be alive if you love moonshine.
If you're just joining us, our guest is John Schlimm. He's the award-winning author of The Ultimate Beer Lover's Happy Hour, and now he's back with a new book called Moonshine, A Celebration of America's Original Rebel Spirit. And John, Tim just got back from Italy, and so we must talk about the difference between grappa and moonshine. I mean, whenever I have tasted grappa, I've thought, this must be what moonshine tastes like.
Well, again, you know, close cousins, not exactly the same thing. Moonshine, as we know it, is a very American creation, you know, right up there with apple pie and blue jeans. You know, it's one of those things that we can kind of claim as our own, but it certainly had origins in Europe. You know, I don't go too much into that in the book, but certainly the moonshiners brought those skills over here. You know, these were the early moonshiners were really great farmer entrepreneurs, but they were also artisans who handcrafted their own destiny. So they brought those skills of, you know, making alcohol to the United States. But it was really when they were here and, you know, on their farms that sort of this light bulb went off. And they're like, look, we can take these fields of corn that we have and we can either, you know, transport them as is, or we can distill them into moonshine and not only make more money, but it'll be easier to distribute. So it's a really great study and lesson in just how wise and smart these folks were, and you know, something that we can kind of draw inspiration from.
And one of the very first moonshiners was George Washington. I mean, did things begin even before he started actually selling and had, what, a two-year run where he really produced a great deal of moonshine successfully?
Yeah, it actually does predate him, you know, not by too many years, but certainly, you know, again, those very first moonshiners who were over here in, you know, around, even in like the 1600s, but certainly into the 1700s, they were starting to make their moonshine, and they just perfected it more and more over the years. And then, of course, they got into a little bit of trouble with the government. You know, they didn't want to pay their taxes. And then when Prohibition came, you know, they were all out banned from making moonshine, but that didn't stop them. In fact, again, speaking to the, sort of the wisdom of the moonshiners, during Prohibition, they mastered the art of supply and demand. When the law said to folks, you are not allowed to sell or drink alcohol, what did that cause? It caused an even greater demand for it, and the moonshiners were right there willing to supply that demand.
And weren't there prohibitions and regulations that were unrelated to taxes that were imposed early on? Because I got the impression that that the moonshiners were so successful that people were basically walking around drunk all the time, and that created a whole set of its own issues.
Well, there was the whole temperance movement, which I chronicle in a chapter called Temperance Tantrum, There were a lot of temperance activists who really railed against alcohol being so readily available at the time. They did believe that too many people were drinking and drinking too much. And so that was another battle that was waged between the moonshiners and the temperance activists. But in the end, when it was shown that when alcohol was actually made illegal, all of the things that the temperance movement thought would go away, like crime and abuse and so many other really awful things, actually skyrocketed. So it kind of went against what the temperance movement actually thought they were achieving. So I think maybe it speaks to when you give people what they want, they're a little bit happier, and maybe the world's a little bit happier. I don't know. We can only speak, for ourselves, but I think everyone's a little bit happier when they get to sip a little bit of moonshine, just like you in the race. I bet that made you a little bit happier.
I had an amazing revival. I finished very strong.
So let's talk a little bit about, Utah is famed for having strange liquor laws, but we've learned to deal with it and work around it and still manage to be a world-class destination. Plenty of tourists come here and also work around it. But as soon as I think Utah has strange laws, you go up into some of those counties in Tennessee and Kentucky where moonshine was produced and where it was run illegally, and they're still dry counties. What did you find in your research about that?
Well, generally what I find about dry counties is that all sounds good, I suppose, to the folks who make those laws, but these counties are anything but dry. I think that you're not going to stop people from getting what they want and enjoying life. So, there certainly are still those dry counties. It seems like such an outdated notion in this day and age. I'm sure we've all been, invited to dry events, dry weddings, dry, which is, of course, always at the discretion of the host. But I think you also find that folks aren't exactly super excited to go to those sorts of things. So, I think it's an outdated notion. And I think the people there, I don't think we have to worry about the folks who live in those places. I think they're getting exactly what they want one way or another.
Okay. You also talk about the connection between moonshine and music, and you cite all of these examples of who sings about moonshine. Talk about that connection.
Yeah, it was so fun to delve into the pop culture aspect of moonshine, because at every level and in every genre of pop culture, whether it's been movies or TV or books or music, moonshine has been absolutely embraced. And when it comes to music, it's probably no surprise that country music has been the most readily to embrace it, whether it's been Dolly Parton singing songs about moonshine or so many of the, Hank Williams, the Third has a really great song about it. Brad Paisley has an entire album titled Moonshine in the Trunk. So there are some really great songs out there that have moonshine. And even today, anytime I'm listening to our local country music station, I almost every single time I will hear the word moonshine mentioned at least once in some country song, which is pretty cool. But you look at TV and you think about, the Beverly Hillbillies and Granny's Spring Tonic. And there's this really fantastic clip that I found where she's making a batch out by the pool in Beverly Hills. And she's determined to go to Washington to give it to both political parties because she feels they both need a little bit of moonshine in their life. And it's a really fantastic clip. And, this is from the 1960s. And I thought, oh, my goodness, that's so relevant today. We need to maybe take some moonshine to Washington today for everybody to have a few sips of.
Say that to Orrin Hatch.
But, also there has been some, iconic movies that have been made involving moonshine, some great books. And so just really to see how pop culture has embraced that is just one one more mark on how moonshine has impacted our culture overall and how really it's just an absolute superstar and icon in its own right.
John, with your description of what's happening in the resurgence of moonshine and the pop culture embracing it and referencing it, I'm still thinking about in the beginning, was there a competitive environment for moonshine in the 16 and 1700s? You know, in Europe, there's a big wine culture, and the immigrants didn't bring the wine culture over. Of course, it's different climate and different growing conditions.
Right.
But, you know, when they looked at that field of corn and decided to make it moonshine, were they competing with other forms of liquor? Or was that the only game in town?
Well, there was certainly beer. You know, and as you know, I come from an old beer family, so that's something I've delved a little bit into and have a great interest in. But I think the main competition, really, in those early days wasn't so much another beverage. It was really the authorities and the temperance activists. So that was really the force that the moonshiners were up against. And time and again, they showed that they could outsmart. You know, for better or for worse, and that can be, you know, debated, but they outsmarted the law on so many occasions. They outsmarted the temperance tantrums, or, you know, those throwing the temperance tantrums. And, you know, and that bears out. 250 years later, their American dream is alive and well, and they've achieved it, which is kind of cool to see that they were able to do that.
Well, alive and well, but, you know, again, beer is ubiquitous. I mean, and we have craft breweries, and now we have craft distilleries doing whiskey, and moonshine is still kind of this underground movement, except, as you point out, it's having this resurgence. And I just wonder, when it came out of temperance, why didn't moonshine become more prominent than other forms of liquor?
Well, I think it was because it had such a reputation as being underground, something that was a little bit forbidden. So I think, you know, rather than bars and restaurants embracing it in those days, it was mostly still an underground thing, even though it had succeeded in coming out on the other end, whereas beer was, I think, more publicly accepted. You know, eventually, I think wine was more publicly accepted. So I think that, you know, what you're seeing today, you know, even though it's, again, 250 years later, we're really at the very beginning of what this renaissance is going to be. And it's really rocking and rolling. It's, you know, it's very much, you know, moonshine today is very much the new craft beer in terms of, you know, everyone wanting to try it and everyone wanting to embrace it. And we'll see the sustainability of that. But, you know, if the last 250 years or any marker on that, I think moonshine is around to stay. But I think it's for those reasons. I think beer was more accepted as something that you could drink with friends and out in the open at bars and restaurants. Eventually wine, of course, was as well. Moonshine, not so much. But that's different now, which is kind of cool.
Yes. Well, my big final question for you is, when you go around to all of these bars and restaurants and places that are now carrying moonshine, how often is it served out of a mason jar?
That is a great question. And it's most often served in a mason jar. I don't often see, like, where, you know, what kind of bottle it comes out of. But certainly if, you know, I love to get a moonshine cocktail in a mason jar. And certainly if I'm having a party or an event and serving it, that's what you're going to get your moonshine cocktail in. And what's great is when you go to the liquor store and you look for Old Smoky, which is a great American moonshine brand, or Junior Johnson's Midnight Moon, those are all in mason jars. So you can certainly, you know, pick up that mason jar, and with every sip, you're enjoying 250 years of great heritage and great adventure and that rebel spirit that we all have.
John, my final question will allow you to wax philosophically, because I want to know, in the context of public acceptance, and you talked about wine and beer and moonshine, what does it say about our culture that today we're at the beginning of this wave of public acceptance? What does it say about our next 25 or 50 years?
I think that it says that the rebel spirit in each and every one of us, no matter who you are or where you are, is alive and well. And there's nothing that is going to extinguish that rebel spirit. And I think, you know, we are a country that is always about new beginnings. And, you know, even after 250 years, you can have a new beginning and a new resurgence. And that's what we're seeing with Moonshine. And that's what I hope people will, you know, in addition to having a good time with this book, I think when they read the historical portion, they're going to really be inspired. And they're going to be inspired to embrace their own rebel spirit and go out and pursue whatever their dreams are. And maybe that's the ultimate legacy that the Moonshiners left us. Whatever you can dream, you can go out and do and just be in it for the long haul. Just like both of you know, when you're out there doing your endurance sports, that's what life's all about. And it's about being happy and enjoying it along the way.
Well said. The book is Moonshine, a Celebration of America's Original Rebel Spirit. John Schlimm is our guest. John, thanks so much for joining us. It was fun.
Thank you. This has been great.
All right. Take care. Oh, boy. How about that?
Yeah. Inspiring. Who knew that Moonshine would give us all those opportunities for self-expression?
That's right. And Old Smoky, is that what he called it? Do you know? I've never looked for Moonshine in our state liquor stores. Do you know if it appears?
I have never looked.
Just look for the mason jar.
We probably could
take a field trip.
We could
downstairs.
Ask Mike Lures.
Oh, we could. Or we could just go downstairs to take a field trip when it opens. You're listening to The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
For adventurers on a budget, the Utah Olympic Park offers a host of activities at no charge. Admission and parking are always free. Start with a tour of the Alf Engen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Winter Games Museum. Best of all, come support athletes from all over the world who train at the park. Open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Details available at UtahOlympicLegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.